Welcome to Political Rewind. We have a full house this afternoon for our live show because we have so much to talk about. Jim Galloway, the political writer of the AJC, is here. Jim, we always ask you on Friday, give us a little preview of what's coming up on Sunday.
If certain parties have their way, next year's Democratic race for governor will be kind of like a feud between Beyonce and Taylor Swift.
Oh, yeah. Actually, you have a little bit of news that we can talk about later on about Stacey Abrams and her campaign for governor. We'll get to that a little bit later in the show. Chip Lake, a Republican strategist and a government affairs guy. I always say that word instead of lobbyist.
You do.
Because it sounds so much more dignified.
Thank you.
Somehow.
I appreciate it. It's good to be here, Bill.
It's
thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And we asked Chip, we asked Heath Garrett, who's been on the show recently, to come back in because he's very close, of course. He's a Republican strategist. He is very close to Senator Johnny Isaacson. And we thought that you might have some insights for us about the Republican side of things last night. So thank you for coming back in, Heath.
Great to be here, Bill.
And progressive activist Blin Olivieri, right?
That's right.
The
thank
Italian.
You.
Say that the way you say it as an Italian.
Olivieri.
Olivieri. I love that. In fact, Blin is a. We have talked on this show a lot about how we think it's important to have some grassroots activists on the show. And you are certainly that, a progressive activist. You're out there as often as you can be fighting for the things you believe in.
That's absolutely right, Bill. And I was one of the co-organizers of the Atlanta March for Social Justice and Women, which was kind of the women's march that happened on January 21st.
All right, well, we're really glad to have you back on the show today. By the way, you last night, I tweeted out something about what was going on in Washington, and you used an Italian expression in tweeting back. What did
That's
you say?
That's right. Che casino, which is like, what a mess.
All right. Well, we'll talk about your perspective on that and a lot more today. Let's, though, start right away. Of course, we all know at this point that the health care bill went up in flames early this morning, something like, what, 2 o'clock or that, something like that. The president, to get right to his comments, was in Queens this afternoon within the past hour talking about how talking with law enforcement officers and troops about the efforts the administration wants to make to support the law enforcement community and fight gangs like M13, which apparently has a big presence in that part of New York. But he did have a couple of things to say about the health care bill failing. So let's listen to what he said.
They should have approved health care last night, but you can't have everything. Boy, oh boy. They've been working on that one for 7 years. Can you believe that? The swamp. But we'll get it done. We're going to get it done. You know, I said from the beginning, let Obamacare implode and then do it. I turned out to be right. Let Obamacare implode.
So that was President Trump within the past hour. Jim, things could not have gone more awry for the Republicans than they did overnight.
Well, for more awry for Mitch McConnell, I will say that I've got my own little theory that that this actually represented something of a revolt among certain members of the Senate Republican caucus led by John McCain.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree with that. And I think one thing we should really point out on the show is that we have seen consistently that Trump and McConnell, what they want to implode is the legacy of Obama. And it's wrapped up in their conception of American healthcare, which is the ACA. But they so focus on Obama. And I really think we ought to stop calling it Obamacare. We want to recognize Obama's tremendous legacy. But it is now the American Health Care Act.
Let's listen. McConnell, whether you think what he was doing was, as Blin says, really just trying to undermine the President Obama's legacy, or whether he had some ideological stake in trying to do something that he thought would be better for the country, no one would deny that this guy, he may have approached it wrong, but boy, he worked hard on it. And at 2 o'clock or so this morning, he took the floor when the three Republicans doomed it by voting against it. And let's just listen to a little of his speech.
This is, you know, clearly a disappointing moment. We worked hard, and everybody on this side can certainly attest to the fact that we worked really hard to try to develop a consensus for a better way forward. So yes, this is a disappointment. A disappointment indeed. Now imagine many of our colleagues on the other side are celebrating, probably pretty happy about all this. But the American people are hurting and they need relief. Our only regret tonight, our only regret is that we didn't achieve what we had hoped to accomplish.
Heath, a correspondent who's covered the Hill for a very long time, made the observation this morning they've never seen McConnell closer to tears than he was in making that speech. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm suggesting we should feel great sympathy for him, because I think a lot of people, including Senator McCain, would say the way they went about this process was cynical and probably was going to end up leading to serious trouble, if not defeat. Nevertheless, we should say that both our senators, Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue, voted for what was the last bill, which was skinny repeal.
That's right.
And the concept was, this weird concept, frankly, was we can't pass a big bill. We definitely can't get support. But if we can pass something, we can send it to the House, get a conference committee, and then we can finally try to achieve a major reform of health care, get rid of it. McCain's been calling for regular order. This was certainly anything but. So it was a strange process to begin with.
It really was. And, you know, and nobody's asking, and Senator McConnell's not asking for sympathy, but definitely he was emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually exhausted after this process. Look, for the country and for Republicans, it's been an exhausting 6 months. And that's just the reality that we all deal with on this. The Senate actually functioned, I thought, very well over the last week as we went through this process. And what doesn't need to get lost in the 24-hour immediate spin is they were within one vote of sending a substantive piece of procedural legislation and getting it into conference committee. So one thing that the Senate, of course, we always forget this, is set up to make sure not much happens in this country. So it's pretty miraculous that McConnell was able to pull together moderate Republicans, liberal Republicans, and a huge conservative base, all with the chaos that the White House is spinning out there in Washington these days. The fact that he got that close is disappointing for him, but 2 weeks ago, we said we'd never get to debate, and we ended up in debate. And now I think that there might be a phoenix that can be resurrected out of this, but it's going to take some time off from everybody.
Chip, I'm a little surprised to hear our friend Heath describe the Senate as having worked pretty well all in all this week. This was a Frankenstein monster of a process to begin with. They didn't have regular order. They put together the bill behind closed doors. And then this week, just scrambling to get anything back to the House to get into conference committee, they came up with all sorts of what I consider to be strange schemes.
I think Mitch McConnell deserves a lot of credit, Bill. He was the clip you played. I've never seen Mitch McConnell so spent in my life. And here's what I mean by that. Not by the spent part, but with respect to deserving a lot of credit. He was able to get one vote of moving this process forward without any help from Democrats, who made it very clear from the beginning they were not going to participate in this process. Well,
were they invited to participate in the process?
They absolutely were invited to participate in the process.
Did
the president not say in December or January, he made it very clear publicly, excuse me, the former President Obama, he said to Democrats publicly, do not participate in this process. And I don't think you could say with a straight face that they did participate in the process. However, I will also say this. McConnell did that with no help from the executive branch, no help from the White House. And the fact that he was
actually
able to get within
little,
one vote,
a good bit of interference. Going after Lisa Murkowski in the way that he did.
Mistake.
He guaranteed a no vote right there.
Yeah, I want to talk about how they played with Lisa Murkowski in a really cynical way in a minute. But Blynn, I want to go back to you just for a second, because you made a point that many people would agree with, that in the long run, this scramble to get something through was more about fulfilling a pledge that they've been making, Republicans have been making for 7 years, than it may have been to truly do something to make healthcare better for the American people. That's your point, right?
That's right, exactly. And I, first of all, I'll say I have zero sympathy for McConnell because he has shown zero compassion for Americans and American healthcare. But what needs to happen is that Democrats, the Democrats that don't see the legislative fixes that need to happen in the ACA, they need to come aboard, and we need to partner with Republicans and across the aisle to come up with fixes to what is our American health care.
Who are those Democrats that believe their problems in the ACA, that are willing to work with Republicans and publicly, that would publicly say that without having problems back home?
Absolutely, yeah. There are Democrats. Senator Patty Murray of Washington State has been very vocal about what fixes need to be made to make it affordable and within reach. And I think that the problems of the ACA have been, you know, well identified by various think tanks, by senators. We know what the issues are.
I think the ground, Chip, you say who works together. I think the ground on this is probably going to be plowed by governors, not members of Congress.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And I talked to Senator Isaacson today at length after what happened last night. He actually believes that out of the, you know, damage of last night, there is a template or a platform for Senator McConnell to take the Democrats up, and I say call their bluff on whether or not they're really willing to work with the Republicans. Now, right so far, what they've been willing to say is, hey, we'll work with you as long as you'd agree to our entire position before we get started.
Let me play, if I can, and then let you say a little more about that. Chuck Schumer responded to Mitch McConnell's comments about Democrats were obstructionists, essentially. Let's listen to what Schumer said early this morning.
I would say to my dear friend, the majority leader, we are not celebrating. We are relieved. But as I said over and over again, Obamacare was hardly perfect. It did a lot of good things, but it needs improvement. So let's turn the page and work together to improve our health care system.
So that's Schumer, the minority leader. I'm assuming that you believe that he's somewhat disingenuous because, as you suggest, Democrats, if they get involved, are going to want to just preserve Obamacare?
Yeah, Senator Schumer's given a number of speeches on the floor of the Senate where he said, here are my non-negotiables, all of which are legitimate criticisms of the Affordable Care Act. Remember, in the arcane time of when it was passed, it used something like the skinny repeal procedure to get it to the Senate, and it was a half-baked concept back then. So we've got to remember that history and know that there has been an attempt on a bipartisan basis quietly to reach out to more moderate Democratic senators, but they have a list of non-negotiables that go right to the heart of things that are fundamental to true reform, and from the Republicans' perspective.
So you talked to Senator Isaacson this morning. He voted for the skinny repeal. Why?
Well, essentially, it's the way the Senate works, and this is the hard part of a substantive debate like this, is in order to move something forward and to continue the debate, you'll find vehicles like what they call the skinny repeal, which has gotten out there. You get it into the conference, and then you come up with a compromised piece of legislation that still has to get the 50 votes in the United States
and
Senate.
And that becomes the worry among Democrats, because it is an up or down vote, no amendments, and there was always the possibility that the House would take the skinny repeal and just shove it through. I don't think senators got enough assurance from House Speaker Paul Ryan that this was not going to happen.
Well, they had the assurance that it would have not passed the Senate had they done that. That's what, I mean, the argument. I mean, there's no way that if you just substitute with the House, it would have gotten an up or down vote in the Senate, but it would have only gotten about 42 votes.
I want to quote one thing, because, Jim, I want you to comment on this. You posted on the AJC Political Insider blog a statement from Earl Rogers, president and CEO of the Georgia Hospital Association. He said this: the proposals being considered last night by the U.S. Senate which would have resulted in millions more patients without health coverage were not solutions we supported. He says there's still no clear path forward for the hundreds of thousands of uninsured Georgians who lack access to health care. and there's little relief for our hospitals who endure more than $1.7 billion annually in uncompensated care. At the same time, he said we are grateful to Isaacson and Purdue for trying to put something in the measure that would help
them. He gave them a pass. He understood. And that's because everyone, if you're on that side of the aisle, or if you're in the mix, the political mix in Georgia, you understand that there is an inherent conflict here between the Georgia Republican base and the Georgia business community when it comes to health care. And the Georgia Hospital Association wants some help, I think.
I think they do. Back to the comment that you played that Chuck Schumer did. Make no mistake about it. This issue is very difficult right now for both parties.
Yeah.
And Chuck Schumer said the right thing in that soundbite that you played. But make no mistake about it. That was from somebody who realized at that point, we just won. And we still own Obamacare.
Yeah, and now what do we do? Yeah,
that's right.
You know, Blyn, just from a tactical point mm-hmm. of view, here's my observation, and you can all weigh in on this, but I'll start with you. It is probably more possible for members of the United States Senate across party lines to come together and figure out some kind of package that maybe the Senate could agree on. But the minute Democrats are involved and make meaningful contributions to a Senate bill, the House is a much different mm-hmm. animal,
absolutely.
And it becomes a real struggle, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Senate is supposedly, as McCain very well pointed out after he voted for the motion to proceed, in his speech he pointed out the Senate is the deliberative body. And I think a health care bill that's coming out of the Senate should really include more substance and legislative fixes to the ACA, including things like government-run insurance programs, which will compete with the private insurance industry.
Yeah, I think that was a remarkable speech that McCain gave. That was what, Tuesday or Wednesday?
It was Wednesday.
Wednesday night.
Tuesday.
And it was basically a call for a return to regular order, which every senator actually probably would prefer because it enhances the power of the process. You have no similar call on the House side. You have no appetite on the House side for a return to regular order, I don't think.
That's right.
All right. I want to throw out, I want to hear from our strategists here. This is just sheer speculation. The president, in the way he, according to most people, did not get involved with this process. Nevertheless, the way he talked about it on the campaign trail constantly. Is there a possibility that overnight, the president bought himself at least a couple of Republicans who may think, I want to maybe think about running against this guy in 2020. Or is that just outlandish?
Well,
Come on, strategist.
No, I'll start.
I think
the president has had an awful week for a lot of different reasons, right? And it's been a challenging 6 months. And so I'm not so sure about whether or not he bought himself an opponent in the primary in a few years. But what I do know is in the United States Senate, starting with McCain's speech and then following on the attack on Murkowski and then the way he's handled himself by either not being a leader on these issues or by jumping in at the wrong time, the Republican caucus of the United States Senate is now willing to stand up and start to articulate a counter-conservative argument for the Republican Party that's different from what the White House is doing.
I can't wait to hear that.
Chip,
name me a time in American history when we've had major policy become law, when the executive branch wasn't wholly and completely behind it and pushed
leading.
All the political capital that they had. And so,
Mitch actually understood the concept.
Mitch McConnell, for all the criticism he's gotten and all he'll get for next week, Mitch McConnell's been the majority leader of the Senate for a long, long time. And Obamacare has been very unpopular for a long time. But there was something that happened the first Tuesday in November of last year that changed people's perceptions of Obamacare. It's now at 55% approval rating. And the first Tuesday in November of last year was at 37% approval rating. Mm-hmm. So people aren't real assured that this president's going to take care of them on this issue.
I have got to get it to a break, but bear with me in the control room. But you mentioned Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator from Alaska. She made it fairly clear she was going to vote against this measure a while ago. The president has called attention to her in the last week or so in a very negative way. And then Ryan Zinke, the Secretary of the Interior, whether on his own or at the request of somebody in the White House, in the, essentially called and threatened her that she's going to lose funding for important projects in Alaska. And here's how Murkowski responded.
Are you concerned at all about political retaliation here?
My vote yesterday was from my heart for the people that I represent. And I'm going to continue working hard for Alaskans and just focus on that.
What do you think when you see a tweet like that from the president?
In fairness, I'm not one who follows the tweets that handily. I know that many are. But I have to focus on my job. I've got to focus on what I came here to do.
Jim, what Ryan Zinske forgot is that she's the chair of the Senate Committee on the Interior,
right.
And has more power, essentially, than he does.
Right. And my goodness, all of the Interior nominations that were supposed to be come up on Wednesday before the committee that she chairs are now put on hold.
She pulled them out of markup.
But now, let me see, just add here, an Interior Secretary does not threaten a sitting U.S. Senator, never mind the chairman of a committee, unless it's under orders.
All right, I've got to take a break. Blyn, hold off, because we've got to get a break in, because they're staring death rays at me from the control room. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back after a very brief break.
Christopher Kimball is bringing his new show, Milk Street Live, to the First Center in Atlanta, September 20th. He'll reveal cooking secrets from around the world, offer taste tests, and invite audience members to join in an onstage cooking contest. Support GPB now, and you'll receive 2 orchestra-level tickets to the show. Attend an exclusive pre-show meet and greet with Christopher Kimball, and receive his newest book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Go to gpb.org/milkstreet. That's gpb.org/milkstreet. And thanks.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network of GPB. I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
We're back on Political Rewind. With us today, Blyn Olivieri.
Thank you.
Is that all right?
That's right. Great job, Bill.
Progressive activist, a grassroots activist. And we also have with us Chip Lake, a Republican strategist. We also have Heath Garrett here, another Republican strategist. Blyn, we know you feel so strongly. We had to have 2 Republicans to balance off the passion that you bring to your issues.
And I'm a woman in a room full of men.
And, of course, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Constitution. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog. Jim, let's talk about the other story that really hit hard last night, and that was the Mooch and his interview. Well, he didn't know it was an interview, but when you call up a reporter from The New Yorker, Ryan Lizza, especially somebody like Lizza, who's a very savvy veteran political journalist, and you start mouthing off without saying it's off the record,
On the record.
Yeah, so talk about that a little.
Well, yeah, I mean,
without saying a single word, we cannot say on the radio.
All right. Well, he forthrightly accused Reince Priebus of leaking quite a bit of information. That's the chief of staff, and clearly, the Mooch is trying to get rid of Mr. Priebus.
He called him a paranoid schizophrenic.
I can use that. All right. I can do that. He is not a fan of Steve Bannon, and I cannot.
No, the remark he made about Bannon was so obscene that we can't even. I don't even think we can describe it in a safe way on the air.
No. Let us say that. If they meet each other in the halls of the White House, there's going to have to be a Secret Service man standing between them.
All right. So, Blyn, when I saw this, when I heard this, by the way, within a couple of days of our own buddy Carter, Congressman Carter, talking about how Lisa Murkowski, and I will say this on the radio because it's only slightly offensive, talked about how somebody ought to bust a knot in her...
No, snatch a knot.
Snatch a knot in her ass. What is... I mean...
Okay, well, here's the thing. Some people were offended by that, but most of us were just baffled.
Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out it's an old Southern expression that I've been told.
In some parts, I'm a pretty old Southerner. I've never heard it.
Okay.
I grew up in South Georgia, and I was told that my employers were going to do that to me on several occasions when I wasn't hustling fast.
Okay, but, you know... I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, a Libertarian. I don't care what your party... preferences are. What is happening to us, Blynn?
Inappropriateness rules.
I mean, yeah.
And Donald Trump and his administration, anything goes. And the bottom line is that Trump is a bully. And he likes people who use colorful language, who intimidate others. If we're going to step back to Zinke calling Senator Murkowski, I mean, he used the language... The president is really disappointed in what he perceives as to be your lack of support for health care reform. Well, he's being a bully, and he's bullying on behalf of Trump in this case. And Trump surrounds himself with people who will bully on his behalf, and that is just... reprehensible.
To me, it is style. I mean, look, I didn't... LBJ was quite forceful. Yeah.
If LBJ had Twitter,
LBJ would be too smart to use Twitter. But LBJ was very good about bringing the person into the room and in one-on-one conversations.
That's different.
Saying but, precisely that, face to face.
But I hate to agree with Blynn on this, but I will because it's not unusual for the executive branch and the White House to exert pressure over members of the of Congress, either in the Senate or the House. But you usually do that when you have political capital or you have leverage. And in this case, specifically, the intimidation tactics that were tried to be employed on Senator Murkowski, they did not have leverage, nor did they have political capital. And you can't do that. Anthony Scaramucci today tweets out, John McCain is the only Democrat to ever win the Republican nomination for president. Does he not realize that his boss contributed to Hillary Clinton's campaign, number one? And number two, you're not going to put political pressure on John McCain. He was a POW for a year. He's suffering from terminal brain cancer, and he's not running for re-election.
And you might need him for tax reform.
All right, so we got two trains of thought going, and that's perfectly fine, because our listeners can have four trains of thought and still follow. But so one of them is this Scaramucci and the New Yorker and the obscene language he used, Heath. And the other is trying to intimidate people like John McCain. So let me start with the Scaramucci stuff. I mean, the reason I love politics, and I'll bet I'm not the only one in this room, is because I watched Jimmy Stewart, you know, in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I read Advise and Consent, the great Alan Drury novel about when senators behaved like adults. Sure, there was a lot of bickering and there was behind-the-scenes dealings, but there was a certain carriage and dignity that they carried off in public.
Oh, my goodness. I was much more apocalyptic. Mine was 7 days in May.
I'll say this. Bill, I talked to one of the most successful Republican operatives in the country last night who had the pleasure, if you will, of working with Scaramucci in some New York politics a few years back. And he said, look, the problem with the guy is he's the caricature everybody thinks he is. He's watched The Godfather 100 times as the movie, not read the book, but watched the movie. And he's watching House of Cards and comes to Washington thinking that's how the game is really played, and it's not. And, you know, my big problem as a Republican with all this is if I'm a small government, free market, conservative, or libertarian, these guys are not helping us advance our agenda one iota in the Senate or in the House. And that's becoming a real problem. The senators are paying attention to that. House members are a little bit more in line right now, but they're eventually. Scaramucci's just another character in this terrible drama.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, Heath. And I think that Republicans and Democrats actually may be building a coalition against Trump and his completely bad judgment and irresponsible behavior. Now, you know, maybe Trump is the factor that brings Republicans and Democrats back together at last. Bombity-bomb-bomb-bomb. It's
well,
taken a while.
Okay, I mean, I want to be careful because we have to remember that President Trump, as Heath pointed out, fell only a couple votes short. I mean, for the most part, the Republicans in the Senate were willing to support this bill because of his belief, that, you know, because they know that was something he pushed over and over on the campaign trail. And of course, they did, too. And his numbers are really bad in terms of approval, but he's still got 36% to 40% of the people with him.
But I will tell you, and I've pushed this theme before. I think we're witnessing the diminishment of the presidency right now. I mean, this was a terrible week for Trump, and not. I mean, the health care vote last night was just the coda. I mean, you have the Pentagon right now saying. Tweets? We don't know tweets.
Yeah,
unless you talk to us through our Secretary of Defense, we won't recognize what you say. That you had the House and the Senate now imposing sanctions over Trump's head
against Russia and North Korea.
They have. Trump will not be able to raise those sanctions without congressional approval.
And that may be where, regardless of whether you mind crude language or not, where something like the Scaramucci incident contributes to the willingness of members of his own party to back away from him at key moments, yes?
Well, we're only 1 week into the job of Anthony Scaramucci, and I've never seen somebody's career evolve so quickly over 72 hours. He came in the first 24 hours. The president loved him. But in his first week on the job, and I got to give Breitbart credit, they certainly know how to push the president's buttons. Mike Lee, Tony Lee, excuse me, had an article that was posted yesterday on Breitbart. The first sentence of that article read, "Move over, President Trump.
Yeah.
You are yesterday's news. It seems like this is now the Anthony Scaramucci show, and Trump better get used to it."
The man's toast.
So because we're on two tracks, let's remind everybody when we talk about the healthcare vote and the fact that McCain really cast the deciding vote, let's go back in the Wayback Machine 1 year to a conversation that Donald Trump, Candidate Trump, had at the Family Research Institute, I think, was the organization.
He's a war
hero. 5.5 years.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Do you agree with that?
He's a war hero because he was captured.
Blynn, I don't know how much of that was in John McCain's mind when he cast his vote. I would think his speech the other day in which he said we've got to do things correctly probably had a bigger impact. But
yes.
It didn't help.
And Bill, we should remember. So I thought that McCain speech was really important. I was disappointed that he voted for the motion to proceed, but nonetheless, he did the right thing in the end. But during McCain's speech, he said, "We," meaning the Senate, "are not the president's subordinates. We are his equals." And I think just like Jim's point, kind of the Senate really taking its power back. And I hope to see more and more of that, especially in this difficult, difficult situation of having an difficult person in the White House.
And having worked in the Senate for one of the great, truly statesmen of our generation, Johnny Isaacson, I'll tell you that the only thing I disagree with John McCain in is that the Constitution does not make the Congress the president's equal. ABC told us with a bill on Capitol Hill that there are three co-equal branches of government. The Constitution makes the Congress a superior branch of government. So what the Senate needs to do, he was wrong, they're not their equal. The Congress actually is the president's superior according to our Constitution. And the Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are going to assert their power now if they can get themselves together. And I think we're right. You're seeing the take back the imperial presidency that modern media has created.
I've got some tweets because a lot of people are tweeting, but before we get to them, let's on the point that you all are making right now, let's listen to what Senator Ben Sasse said from the floor of the United States Senate responding to the Trump attacks on Jeff Sessions.
If you're thinking of making a recess appointment to push out the Attorney General, forget about it. The presidency isn't a bull, and this country isn't a china shop. Mr. President, you're a public servant, in a system of limited government with a duty to uphold and to defend and to teach to our kids the Constitution system of checks and balances.
All right, that was Senator Ben Sasse. Chip, I would argue that in February of 2017, there isn't a single Republican senator who would have made a statement like that.
No, I agree. And you have to wonder, does the president dislike his job so much? And I don't think he's having fun. I don't think it's anything about what he thought is the expectations of the job might be, that he's just going to do everything his way. And I don't think there's a scenario, at least I don't see a realistic scenario, that he gets impeached. But is there a way that he leaves office before the end of his term where he could claim victory and blame the establishment of both parties and the mainstream media, and he could go back to doing what he's doing? There's almost no logical other scenario than to think that might be a possibility, given what's been going on, especially over the last couple of weeks with the Sessions thing as well.
Let me read some tweets. We're going to have to take a break, but before we do that, let me read a few tweets. Ted Barfield tweets, this process exposed that GOP caucus is not a reliable conservative caucus. Essentially, the Senate is now majority center left. Okay, I understand, but I'm not sure I see it. The other JC tweets, three senators voting no is not a revolt. It's a good start. Thought Crime says, I taught at Emory for 16 years. Stop calling having health insurance being equal to health care. 250,000 people a year die with insurance. So he makes the right point. We've made that. Probably mistake is a fair thing to say in some ways, Jim. All of us in the media.
Well, I'm going to parrot Roy Barnes. People die every day.
All right. Brian Tolar says, thank you, Senator Isaacson and Senator Perdue, for having the vision and courage to advance a health care fix. So we've got people from all sides listening to the show and tweeting, and we appreciate that. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Let's get another break out of the way because we still have an awful lot to talk about. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Vic Mensa was 12 years old when he became aware of how people perceive him.
I'm me. I'm half African, I'm Irish, I'm German, I'm all of these things, but the police don't know it.
At age 12, I learned the difference between white and black. Police pulled me off of my bike.
Mensa on his new album, The Autobiography, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's 4 till 7 this afternoon right here on GPB.
My name is Diamandis Papadopoulos. I am the medical director at Metroderm. Metroderm is a dermatology/dermatologic surgical practice in Atlanta with 18 providers. I wanted to participate in underwriting for public radio. The integrity of what I was listening to made me feel like I wanted to be part of that message, and that represented us, and it was something I felt very positive about doing.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Blin Olivieri.
That's right.
Heath Garrett and Chip Lake join us today. I always run out of time at the end of the show, and there's something I want to say, a little piece of business I'd like to get out of the way right now so we don't run out of time for it. Peyton Hawkins, who's been our intern here this semester, is leaving us today. She's been, is she gone already? Well, okay, Peyton, I hope you're listening on the radio. We had a great time having you here with us, and we wish you well as you finish your academic career. Let's talk about a couple more issues that are really, as Jim talks about the bad week the president has had. One of them is, of course, that he really, really has gotten blowback on two issues. One is his continued attacks, which seem to have stopped in the last few days, on Jeff Sessions. Tucker Carlson finally tracked Sessions down and got him on the record responding to how Trump's been treating him.
But the president of the United States is a strong leader. He is determined to move
lead this country in the direction he believes it needs to go to make us great again. I serve at the pleasure of the president.
Yes.
If he wants to make a change, he can certainly do so, and I would be glad to yield in that circumstance, no doubt about it. But I do believe that we are making tremendous progress. I can feel the movement that we're doing.
Jim, any number of liberal observers have made the point that it took Donald Trump for them to start feeling sympathetic to Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, but did you notice what Jeff Sessions said? He says, I'm here until you pick up the phone or write me a letter and fire me.
Yeah, yeah. Gotcha.
And I have no respect for Jeff Sessions. I have no sympathy for him. I mean, so Donald Trump attacks everyone across the spectrum, but Jeff Sessions should have no mercy with his criminal justice reforms, which are just ill-placed and are harmful to our traditionally underrepresented communities.
Well, I think that's certainly why a number of liberals are saying, who would have thought we'd feel sympathy for Sessions? The other story that really seemed to have hurt the president this week was his tweet out of the blue saying no longer will transgender individuals be allowed to serve in the military without any follow-up at all. He didn't say if that meant currently serving transgender soldiers would be thrown out. No policy except that we've been told by the White House that a tweet is now official presidential policy. So,
right. And so now we've got this whole, Republicans are even caught off guard here. The military leadership was caught off guard. This issue is kind of the ongoing issue that is going to erode his support even amongst, the conservative base or the Republican Party, which is an issue that Chip and I are going to be dealing with politically for the next 18 months. I got a little bit of an inside story from somebody in the White House on how this materialized. There was discussion about repealing the funding of transgender payments of these conversions in the military. He heard that part of the conversation and just decided to go beyond what was being requested and sends out a much broader tweet that is now everybody's trying to walk back or figure out what it is. And it's that kind of process that's not helpful to address. Even if he has a legitimate agenda item here.
This is the military. The military, bless its heart, it does not move fast. No. I mean, we debated the whole 1990s was a debate over open service for gay members of the military, and the same thing has been going on the transgender issue for years. And so to think you can solve it with a tweet, number one, is a little bit ridiculous. You've got 5,000 or so current members who now have their status in limbo. It's going to cost $50,000 to force them out of the service. Each one. That's a big number. And then here's the thing. This is how much time has changed. Okay, all right. After that tweet came out, you had Richard Shelby of Alabama.
Yeah.
You had Orrin Hatch of Utah come out and say, no, this is wrong. If you are willing to serve your country, we ought to let you serve your country.
Yeah, Blynn, Jim makes a good point, because if the president thought perhaps that one of the things he was doing by sending out this tweet was appeasing a conservative base that was upset about the way he was treating Jeff Sessions, because there had been a lot of blowback on that, if you've got a Richard Shelby in Alabama opposing you, you're not really doing a lot to rally the troops around you again.
That's exactly right. I mean, again, one of Trump's bad missteps and misalignment with how society in America has changed. I want to step back to what Heath was referring to, because basically in mid-July, Secretary of Defense Mattis went to Congress and spoke privately to Representative Vicky Hartzler of Missouri. And she was the one that had added on this amendment to the $696 billion National Defense Authorization Act, which would have blocked the military from paying for gender reassignment surgeries and hormone therapy for service members and their families. So that's the actual background that Heath was referring to. And then apparently now I hear from Heath that what happened is Trump was sort of hearing about this and thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to tweet out about this.
Chip, I think there's one more step. Mm-hmm. Her amendment could have shut down the entire spending bill.
Right.
But there's an important piece of that spending bill that Donald Trump is committed to dealing with. That's the down payment on the wall.
Yeah.
As much as anything else, the president may have overreacted. But among other things, he was trying to protect that funding.
That's exactly right. And he hit the nail on the head. And just to show how little thought there was to the policy, the Defense Secretary, General James Mattis, was on vacation this week. And he had no idea that there was going to be policy coming out of the White House. And we're arguing whether or not it was policy on the White House. So clearly, he thought it was time to change the subject on the Sessions dialogue, Russia and healthcare. And he did change the subject. But at the same time, these other issues didn't go away for him.
I'm going to add in one final thought, because James Mattis is just a hero of mine. But he has consistently said that the Department of Defense will continue to treat all service members with dignity and respect.
He meaning the president or General Mattis?
No, General Mattis. And as a part of a military family, General Mattis has just consistently defended the dignity and of service people, and I just unending respect for that.
And anybody named Mad Dog, you kind of got to.
And it's unkosher to call him Mad Dog. Only the Marines can call him Mad Dog.
All right.
By the way.
Look, all right. So we've got just a little while left, and let's. I think we can all agree, and I think it's fascinating to hear Chip and Heath, two Republicans. I know you want to the best of your ability. Do everything you can to keep your party supported and hopefully moving forward. But there's no one in this room who isn't really concerned and disappointed about what's happened with the president this week. Fair statement?
I think that's fair. You know, we're sitting here struggling. We agree with the underlying policy probably 90% of the time here. There's 10% that we don't as Republicans. And that's true of any Republican president, because we're not collectivists like my Democratic friends. But at the end of the day, it's getting difficult because process and public relations do matter. And, he's getting in the way of us achieving a more limited government, a smaller government, more free market principles, more choice, and more liberty.
Yeah. If you're an executive in politics, meaning you're a governor or a mayor or a president, you're only effective as your ability to accumulate political capital, and then how much political capital you have to spend to get done what it is that you want to get done on your agenda. And this president so far looks like he doesn't know how to accumulate the capital, and he certainly doesn't know how to spend what limited capital.
All right, let's change subjects because we only have a few minutes left. Jim, we're going to turn to you on this. Before we turn to the local story, you've been saying for weeks, well, at least certainly since Scaramucci was named director of communications, Reince Priebus is out. Are we expecting to see that soon?
I think the clock's ticking.
Okay. We'll watch. We'll see who the next chief of staff is.
I think it was until the Ryan Lizza interview. I think that bought Reince Priebus some more time.
Interesting. All right. Let's change subjects. Jim, you had a really interesting piece, I thought, that relates to the Georgia governor's race, the Democratic race. And here the headline was, Stacey Abrams says people of color have to be centered in my campaign. What was she saying?
This is what I'm trying to expound on Sunday. You've got within the Democratic Party, there's been the feeling that your lead candidates need to look like the people that you're after. And in terms of Democrats, the white independents, all right? Stacey Abrams is trying to win the Democratic primary nomination for governor by subverting that strategy with building an alliance between white progressives and specifically African American women.
So you quote her. She was
She made those remarks on a podcast called Hellbent,
right?
Which is a feminist podcast. Yesterday,
we keep losing. We keep trying to convince people who've told us now since 2002 they don't want to be here anymore. It's like chasing someone you dated who broke up with you. They're just not that into you. I'm not going to shy away from the fact that people of color have to be centered in my campaign, because I know I can talk to people of color and white people at the same time, and they're not going to recoil from one another. That's
It is a difference of emphasis more so than anything else.
But it's also a statement to be proven, Blynn.
Absolutely. And I have a lot of respect for Stacey Abrams. She's certainly someone I will vote for. And I think what's really important, and it's true in America, so on the national as well as the local, is that people of color are America, and we must all be centered sort of in the middle to work for the betterment of and the health of Americans. And when we can see that people of color have been so marginalized, and there have been people who have had white allies sort of be these sort of power behind the throne people. And really, I really respect Stacey Abrams' statement, because what she's putting here is that people of color lead.
Okay, Chip, though, let me say that everything Blynn just said is a good thesis.
If the math works.
If the math works, and that's the key, isn't it? I mean, that we know Republicans are going to have just a titanic battle to pick a nominee. But how would you like to be a strategist on the Democratic side, trying to figure out how you navigate between a white candidate, a female white candidate who grew up in poverty,
Stacey Evans of Smyrna,
and an African American candidate who also has great appeal in her own community? This is going to be a really difficult battle for Democrats to figure out.
Well, it's going to be, and I don't pretend to understand Democratic. I have a hard enough time understanding Republican politics nowadays. But as a Republican, again, I can tell you, we are going to be watching this race as close as we've ever watched a Democratic primary statewide in Georgia. It's going to be fun to watch.
Keith?
Yes, and there's whichever Democratic candidate can cross racial boundaries, because both have to do it in order to win the primary. And they've got to do that without running off by attracting only white progressives, a large and growing swath of independent white voters.
All right, we have just a few seconds left for you.
And I think the really important thing that's happening within the progressives is that white people are realizing that they need to step back. And this is where, if I were Stacey Evans, I'd step back.
Well, I don't think that's likely to happen.
I know.
But that's fascinating.
But that's actually what needs to happen.
That's a big statement. Big news. I hate it. We're out of time.
Right. Jim, it's been an exhausting week. I mean, we're about out of time, but thank goodness it's Friday, because trying to stay on top of the news that's broken this week has been probably more exhausting than any other week, even since Trump became president.
Yeah, I'm calling my senator, Johnny Isaacson, and asking for a 9-day week.
By the way, Johnny Isaacson passed another bipartisan piece of legislation last night, Veterans Choice, so there is something happening somewhere.
Well, we look forward to having him come in and talk to us about how life is in the Senate for him these days, and we're going to try to work that out very soon. Chip Lake, Keith Garrett, Blynn Olivieri, and Jim Galloway, thanks so much. Thank you to Olivia and to Jenny and to Tyler and to Lisa Clark. We appreciate all the work you've done today. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll be back Monday at 2 with Brian Robinson and Senator Nan Orrick, as well as my partner, Jim Galloway. Have a great weekend.